Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 2nd, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Today, we'll be examining developments of the last 2 weeks and their implications, both short and long term. We've entered into what Lyndon LaRouche has called the dangerous season, a time when the desperate and out-of-control oligarchs in the Anglo-Dutch imperial faction are prepared to do anything, and I emphasize the word anything, to maintain their control, including launching a Weimar-style hyperinflation, which will devalue the dollar and destroy what's left of the U.S. and world economy, and also including the use of political dirty tricks in the U.S. election, possibly even assassination, to elect their chosen candidate, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, to impose a Mussolini corporatist fascist regime in the United States. In both public meetings and private discussion this week, Mr. LaRouche emphasized that what we're seeing implemented as policy is, quote, absolutely clinically insane, unquote. He was referring to the calls from investment bankers and the financial press for a further cut in interest rates beyond the 1.25% cut in the federal funds rate pushed through by Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke over the last 2 weeks, which, along with the so-called stimulus package, is accelerating the rate of growth of inflation. But he's also speaking more broadly about the seeming inability of anyone outside of himself and his association to speak the truth about the deepening crisis of our civilization and to offer a serious alternative. We'll be joined on the program today by Helga Zepp LaRouche, who is not only a political leader in Germany, but a true world citizen who represents the ideal discussed by another great world citizen, Friedrich Schiller. We'll also be joined by Sky Shields, who is leading a team of LaRouche Youth Movement members in breakthrough scientific research in Leesburg, Virginia, putting together a pedagogical demonstration of what hyperinflation is as a physical phenomenon, and also by Mihwa Steger, who is a leader in work with the LaRouche Youth Movement on discovering the universal principles in music and culture, which are coherent with universal physical principles in science. So we got a lot to get to, so let's get started. Helga, welcome to the program.
Yes, hello.
To begin our discussion, why don't you tell us what every citizen should know about what happened this last week and the broad implications of these events?
Well, I think what we experience now around the world is that actually a growing number of people who have been confronted with the analysis of my husband about the inevitability of the systemic collapse of the system, they all come now, they call us, they telephone us, and they say, oh my God, it's really happening. And I think, you know, you see right now a recognition that, you know, the prognosis which he made on the 25th of July last year, where he said that the system already had collapsed and that what we will see in the next weeks and months would just be the coming to the surface of a process of collapse which already has occurred. Now, this was truly prophetic because it took exactly 3 days until, you know, the U.S. subprime market started to collapse with the hedge funds of Bear Stearns. Then you had the credit crunch, which started in August. You had a banking crisis erupting in Germany, which was called the worst crisis since 1931 by Jochen Sanyo, who is the head of the equivalent of the SEC. And then in the third quarter, the major investment banks started to make major write-downs. Then the fourth quarter, they were very shy to really reveal the amount of losses. But exactly as my husband, Mr. LaRouche, said before Christmas, that from the 3rd of January onward, you would see a complete phase change. And that is now unfolding. And what happened in the last 2 weeks is essentially, you know, with the Black Monday, you know, where basically the monoliners, insurance firms went basically over the cliff. And then you had the Société Générale hoax, where supposedly this lone assassin was defrauding the company by $5 billion. And then, you know, the Fed lowered the interest rate to first 3/4 of a percent, and then last Wednesday, another 0.5%. And, you know, basically there is a complete state of panic right now, because now it becomes clear that wave after wave, this thing is coming down. The rating agency Standard & Poor already downgraded the subprime bonds of a volume of $50 billion. And just yesterday, the international financial media were reporting that they are downgrading further papers with a volume of another $484 billion dollars. And that concerns mortgage-backed securities. It concerns CDOs. And, you know, basically this is just going to go into next phases of collapses. And then you have now, you know, the consequences of all of this is that other areas will be hit. I already mentioned the so-called monoliners like MBIA or MBEC. They are basically supposed to be, they have secured papers and bonds worth of $2,300 billion. That's $2.3 trillion. And they have basically secured so-called structured products of all kinds, you know, among them, for example, $800 billion, which are backed with subprime bonds from the U.S. subprime market. So this thing is all coming tumbling down. And, you know, this is not the end of it, because, you know, just yesterday or 2 days ago, the leading Swiss newspaper, the financial newspaper Le Temps, which is published in Geneva, but it's read also in Zurich and in other places, they basically say something which is not said in Germany, but they say that now the next phase will be the collapse of the German banking system. And there, especially the state-owned banks. And, you know, for example, another bank called Hypo Real Estate Bank, which is exposed with $44 billion in the American subprime market. And it just does not stop. So, you know, you will see other developments, which is now already in the media, that on top of the U.S. real estate mortgage crisis, you will have another meltdown, and that is the fact that a new foreclosure wave is threatening in the United States concerning car credits. Because, you know, because of the general situation of the car industry in the United States, the average time people who buy cars take loans or take credits is 7 years. I mean, that is quite amazing. I mean,
well,
that shows you how
the cost of a car is what you used to pay for a house.
Yes.
But we don't have inflation, according to our experts.
Yeah, and the volume of this is $600 billion annually.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is now supposed to bust. So this is all absolutely insane. And the idea of the Federal Reserve to lower the interest rate, to basically pump in money, to have stimulus packages and so on, all of this is feeding inflation. And, you know, it's an untenable situation, because this will lead to a dollar collapse even more than it is already now.
Let me ask you about that, Helga, because our president went on television the other night and said the state of the U.S. economy is strong, as the dollar yesterday came to a near record low against the euro. It's starting to fall again. And your husband last weekend put out a proposal for not only stopping the dollar collapse, but sticking it to the speculators by going with a two-tier credit system with high interest rate for speculators and low interest rates to the protected side of the firewall to stimulate real production. What have you gotten some response on that, and what are your thoughts on this proposal?
Well, I think that, you know, look, I think that the pain will become worse and, you know, people will suffer a lot, unfortunately. But eventually, I think there has to be a government protectionist kind of a reflex. For example, you know, I think that when we started to talk to European contacts in the banking community and elsewhere about this, they were all very interested and said, well, that's actually true. China is already having a two-tier system. You know, they have a yuan for the domestic economy and they have a renminbi for the international trade. And this makes a lot of sense because you have to stem speculation in this way. And, you know, even if it was not expected, President Sarkozy of France, you know, who basically is also confronted with a collapsing French economy, came out of the London summit with Merkel, Prodi, and Braun, you know, and this meeting was completely unwilling to address the real issue. And they made a similar idiotic statement saying that the fundamentals of the European economy are sound. And he said, well, that if there is no transparency, then he may have to impose protectionist measures. And that the whole problem was that a banking system had developed which gave the power to the speculators and not to the entrepreneurs, and that he would do something about it. And even in Germany, of all places, which, you know, I have been campaigning here for, actually, I was against the introduction of the euro in the first place in the beginning of the 90s because I knew this was a construction which would not work. And I have been campaigning for a return to the D-mark because a country which does not have the sovereignty over its own currency, in a crisis like that, you can see that you have absolutely no means of defense. So I have been putting out various programmatic proposals how the German economy could be protected. And, you know, it seems that a first little reflection is the fact that Spiegel of this coming week reports that in the economic ministry there is now a discussion about the stability and growth law from 1967, and that even weeks ago the economic minister Gloss wanted to get rid of this altogether forever, but that now they are reviewing it and that it definitely will be not put off the table. Because, you know, there is a recognition that you need the instruments which were made by wiser people like the Grand Coalition in 1968 to protect the common good under these kinds of circumstances.
You're listening to Helga Zepp-LaRouche, who's our guest today on The LaRouche Show. We will take your email questions. You can send them to us at radio@larouchepub.com. That's LaRouchePub.com, radio@larouchepub.com. Now, Helga, you mentioned the response of Sarkozy at this meeting, the discussion at least of transparency, which is pretty weak. But I suspect you weren't so surprised to see a French reaction given the operation at Société Générale last week. You wrote something about it. What is the story about this so-called lone trader?
Well, that is a really a totally ridiculous story that one individual, like a 30-year-old, you know, not so important employee, should have been able to hide losses of up to 5 billion euros, that's $7 billion. And so even the head of Société Générale, we know from some inside circles, feels that he has been set up by a combination. It's not so clear exactly, but in any case, you have to differentiate in this case between, on the one side, that it was an attack against France, because Sarkozy, who was on a state visit in India at the time, was not even told for 5 entire days, from the 18th to the 23rd of January, that Société Générale was in this crisis. And it was clearly an attack on France. But, you know, it is also, and that's the hypothesis which we also discussed with a lot of people in Europe, which was put out by Lyndon LaRouche, that it was a conspiracy by the British oligarchy to drive down the dollar to basically force the Federal Reserve to go with the interest rate cuts and to go in the hyperinflationary direction to destroy the United States as a republic forever. Now, when you say this in the first place, most people say, oh, my God, you cannot say this. This is a conspiracy theory. That's completely crazy. But, you know, I think I always tell people, when you try to analyze occurrences in the day-to-day political life, don't just think in a two-dimensional way. Try to understand what happened in history, and you always will see that behind certain so-called, you know, market developments or financial developments, there is always an intention behind. And, you know, the best example is really the hyperinflation which happened in Germany between 1922 and 1923, where you had a complete blowout of the system, you know, in a hyperinflationary spiral. And while you can account for, you know, certain mechanical explanations why this happened, the intention was to destroy Germany forever. Because, you know, first of all, it's not now time to go into the whole prehistory before World War One, which is much more complicated than the acknowledged history is saying. We have published a lot about it, especially about the role of the British in orchestrating.
Yeah, but suffice it to say, there was a British operation that you could call a conspiracy to create what became World War One.
Yeah, so I just want to refer our listeners to the articles we wrote about that, which we have very thoroughly documented. But then you had the First World War, and, you know, it was very clear that not only was Germany not the only guilty party for World War One, but, you know, it was very clear that the Versailles Treaty, which made Germany pay the entire debt of the First World War, not only its own debt, which was, you know, significant, but also the debt of the to France, to Great Britain, to Belgium, to Italy, and then also the debt all of these countries had to the United States, which had given loans to the countries during the war. So Germany was burdened with a debt structure which was way, way beyond its ability to pay it. And anybody who did that had to know that Germany could not survive it. And that exploded in the hyperinflation of 1923. So I just think it's important to understand that when you make certain rules and when you make certain you know, like you set up a certain arrangement, that shows you what is the intention. And, you know, right now it's very clear that any effort to maintain the present volumes and mountains of worthless papers, which, you know, the banking system is sitting on, by simply, you know, putting in more money, by lowering interest rates, by making stimulus packages, has only one intention, and that is to destroy the industrial basis of the respective countries, especially in this case the United States. And you know, my husband has made the point. And I think if you know history and you understand that what is operating right now is exactly the same kind of process which occurred in the 1920s and 30s, where the international financial oligarchy consciously choose Mussolini, corporativism first, then, you know, the imposition of austerity in Germany from the Müller government to the Brüning government, and then finally Hjalmar Schacht and Hitler, and in a similar way Franco and the Pétain regimes in Spain and France, then you understand that the oligarchy has their own remedy, how they want to get out of this meltdown of the system, namely by lowering the living standard of the population by 30, 40, 50% or more. And that naturally is not possible without dictatorships.
And that's why we see the Bloomberg option, as Lyndon LaRouche is insisting that people have to look at this and understand that this is a serious intention. Now, Helga, before we get to, I'm going to bring Sky Shields in a moment to go through a little more detail on what they're doing to show the parallels between 1923 in Germany and the present. But one thing that people in the United States get stuck on, they say, well, why would they do this? Why do they think this policy will work? How do you answer that?
Well, I think that what we have said many times, in a crisis like this, or even in lesser crises, there is only one institution which can defend the common good of the people, and that is a state based on republican principles and bound by constitutional criteria linked to natural law. And it just happens to be that in history, the creation of the United States as a republic by the founding fathers has been and is still the most successful model of a nation state where the Constitution says that a government is only legitimate when it defends the common good of the people, not only in the present but also in the future. And, you know, if you look at the European situation, even if you have some good things in the German basic law, which I'm now, you know, pushing a lot because that's a reference point for the defense of the common good in Germany. But the problem is that Europe has really made itself impotent by creating the euro, by, you know, allowing the European Central Bank to have the superiority over national governments and to have the sovereignty over the currencies and not the national governments. But the EZB is not a lender of last resort, and they couldn't care less if you have national banking crises, which, you know, you do need a lender of last resort, but the European national central banks are powerless because they have given that power away. So if you look at where should a solution come from, in this present world situation, Europe will not do it. I'm very unhappy about it because, you know, I think Europe is a bunch of very nice countries, but they have given the power away, and therefore I do not expect them to initiate anything to address this global problem. And the United States, because of its history and because especially of the tradition of Franklin D. Roosevelt, who only 70 years ago demonstrated that with the policies of a New Deal and then eventually a new Bretton Woods, you can overcome even a depression. You can take state credits, you bring the production back in motion, and you can overcome a depression by certain economic policies. And, you know, that tradition is what could be revived and what Lynn and the LaRouche organization in the United States is practically reviving right now. And, you know, that is why, you know, why the international oligarchy with the headquarter in varying between the Cayman Island and the city of London, naturally they have allies in other places, but that's where the headquarters is. They want to eliminate the United States as a republic. And I think that has to be understood because that is really what is at stake in the United States right now.
And that's very important. And I would encourage the listeners to listen to this again to get that point that Helga just made. You're saying that they would prefer fascism and war to a return to the principles of FDR.
Well, you know, if you study how much effort the, let's say, the predecessors of the neocons and their British allies, I'm referring to H.G. Wells, to Bertrand Russell, mm-hmm. to Samuel Huntington, and, you know, the whole tradition which they represent in the United States, how much effort they have done to eliminate the axioms of thinking in the American population, which, you know, appreciated and loved FDR. You have to look at the role of the Frankfurt School in the post-war period. You have to look at the entire cultural warfare of the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which was a gigantic operation both in the United States and also in Europe, in Western Europe. If you look at the entire paradigm shift, which, you know, away from a productive society to a post-industrial society, I mean, these people have really spent an enormous effort to move away from the paradigm of FDR, simply because they know that when the crisis was really acute, FDR stepped in and he contained the power of Wall Street and, you know, defended the good, the common good of the people, and they do not want this to happen again.
Well, we've lived through that paradigm shift, and we've been fighting it, and Lyndon LaRouche stands alone as someone for 40, 50 years has been offering alternatives to it. And now we have a youth movement that's taking up this fight, and I want to get to Sky in just a second, but I would encourage listeners to call in to get a copy of the pamphlet on the webcast given by Lyndon LaRouche on January 17th, titled 6 Months into the Greatest Financial Collapse Ever. And you can call us at 800-929-7566 to get a copy. That's 800-929-7566. And you can go to the website, LaRouchePack.com, to see some of the to see the daily, two or three times daily updates that we're posting. One of the people working on that website is our guest now, Sky Shields, who's working in the so-called basement on work of great scientific importance. Sky, what are you guys preparing right now to make clear what Helga just described as this Weimar-style hyperinflation?
One thing that Lyndon LaRouche has been stressing and that we've passed around in discussions here amongst ourselves working in the basement is that, as Helga made clear, the fight that we're looking at is a fight between the concept of empire and the idea of a nation state, the principle of a nation state. And that the intention right now coming largely out of the City of London as a representative, the most active representative today of this concept of empire, is to destroy the United States as a nation state, because this is the prime example of what's possible in terms of potential for the development of human society. And before they can establish a global empire, they'd have to destroy the United States as a principle and take the population back to something primitive and controllable, the kind of peasant class that you have underneath an empire. And that means reducing the population of the world down to something less than 1 billion people, which isn't something they're actively pushing from both the right wing and the left wing. And then to make sure that it's a population of just very stupid people. And that's something that's been in process for a long time. One of the major ways of accomplishing that has been destroying people's concept of history. So in order to make clear for the population what it is that Helga's describing, we've got to revive this idea of history as a living process, as a process of intention, and not just a series of events which took place. And so LaRouche's idea was that it would be possible to take that, because we've cut our teeth on some earlier scientific projects of going through and making some fundamental discoveries of principle, primarily the work of Johannes Kepler and Carl Friedrich Gauss, making that clear in a pedagogical form to a population which has had no access to that, that's been deprived of this sort of knowledge, this sort of re-experience of principle. Because we've had the experience of making that clear to people, that it would be possible for us now to take this exact same, the crisis we're looking at now, and make the process that underlies it clear to people, primarily by illustrating the fact that what the intention that underlies the destruction of the United States today is the exact same intention launched by the exact same people during the period of the destruction of Germany during the 20s and leading into the fascist takeover of Europe in the 30s.
And so you've put together on the website an initial 4-minute video that is available on the LaRouche Pack website. What are you working on now?
Now the idea is to expand that. People should really take a look at what's there currently to get an idea of exactly how the process took place. What's on the website currently functions as an illustration of what Lyndon LaRouche has called, created to describe this sort of collapse function, his triple curve. Because that way, as Helga said, this gets you past looking at all the specifics. Because you're in the middle of a war, and you know that the enemy has a very specific intention. And because the empire is empire is not creative. Empire will use the exact same tactic over and over and over again. And it depends on having a population stupid enough to fall for the same trick over and over and over again in order to function. So the importance is for people to look at that and get an idea of what was the principle that lay underneath the assault on Germany in that period. And what we're producing currently is going to be an expanded discussion of that, but then a look in detail at what's gone on in the United States really since the 60s, I mean actually since prior to that, and we'll discuss some of that, but with a focus on what was done through the course of throughout the course of the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, up to the present period, to see what the breakdown was in the United States and to see how every single step of this was something that was intended. This is something that was launched, run largely through London, through a corrupt, traitorous element in the United States, in order to destroy, first in the minds of the population, and then physically, the idea of the United States as a republic. And that's what we're illustrating now. We're in the process of pulling together some of the pedagogicals, the videos, the animations, the clips, to give people a living sense of this historical process, not as something that you study out of a history book, but as something that people are living.
And, Sky, not to put any more pressure on you, but how long do you think it will be before that's going to be available?
That, we're thinking a matter of days.
Okay.
In a matter of days, we should have a completed product that we can put out. We may refine it more over time, but the plan is to have something deployable very soon.
Helga, this when you talk to people in the United States about Weimar hyperinflation, it doesn't even ring a bell for most people, but I assume still in Germany there's a real sense that people have heard about this. They know its connection to the destruction of politics in Germany. Is there do you get a sense that people in Germany are looking at the present situation and can make this connection, make the parallels?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even people who have not experienced it because they were born later, I think there is not one person, maybe there is one, but not more, who has not heard from their parents, their grandparents, stories of, you know, how it actually happened, because, you know, hyperinflation is not something which happens in the books of the banks, but it means, for example, that, you know, all the savings and the wages are eaten up.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the period between the spring of 1923 and November of 1923, you know, when the hyperinflation collapsed, a pound of bread would be, in the beginning, maybe one Reichsmark, then five, then 10, then 100, then 1,000, then 1,000,000, then 1,000,000,000, then 1,000,000,000,000, and then it ended. And in the very end, people were taking wheelbarrows full of freshly printed notes, Reichsmark, running to the baker, because if they would be half an hour later, the price would have already quadrupled or something. And, you know, in the end, it just people, you know, in the end, people were using banknotes for wallpaper because it was cheaper to cover your walls with notes of trillions of Reichsmark than to buy actual wallpaper. And people used it for to put it on little blocks to sit on. And, you know, it had all kinds of uses. But, you know, I think, you know, when a family, for example, thought they had 10,000 Reichsmark put away in the savings account for, you know, their old age or something, you know, and then they realized, well, a pound of bread is 10,000. It eats it up. And that is something, you know, which I also want to tell you, because Bernanke, the head of the Fed, he is world famous, or infamous, I should say, of having said already many years ago, well, before we allow a collapse of the system, we will take helicopters full of money and just dump it over the city. And it is an open secret among certain financial circles that hyperinflation is the very last means of the oligarchy to steal from the large population, from the population at large. Because, you know, you just take everything away what they possess. And naturally, the big speculators, the big financial oligarchs, the Wall Street tycoons, they know that since a long time, and they think that they have put their money into values, you know, like mines and gold and oil and other, you know, physical things, and that they can outlive this inflation. But it is a very conscious policy to take the property and the savings, life earnings of the population. And it's a very, very sadistic and mean thing to do, because everybody knows it has that effect.
Well, and you mentioned earlier that after the hyperinflation, there was a brutal regime of austerity, which why don't you just brief people on what happened then, because that was actually the other side of the hyperinflation was the beginnings of the move toward fascism.
Well, you know, I mean, basically when this system, which, you know, obviously was in Germany only limited to one country, and now we have it on a world scale, but nevertheless, that regime contributed greatly to the big, you know, financial crisis of 1929 and then the banking crisis of the early 30s. And at that time, you know, it was the absolute mistake which was made to go for a restrictive policy, to go for austerity, to go for a deflationary policy, which, you know, just is the other side of the coin. It's equally wrong, because as the equivalent of Franklin D. Roosevelt in Germany, his name was, he's an economist called Dr. Wilhelm Lautenbach. What he basically said is, when you have the double condition of a world financial crisis and a world currency crisis and a depression, the normal mechanisms of the market do not any longer function. And that is true, because the stimulus package cannot work based on the experience of the last depression, at least in Europe, because you have a confidence crisis. People are afraid. People are afraid that they don't have a pension. They are afraid they don't have a health system. So therefore, even if you give everybody $1,000, you know, it just doesn't mean people will spend that money, because they have a deep, deep felt mistrust, and it just does not work. So, you know, what they tried to do at that time was the Müller government by brutal austerity, and that brutal austerity naturally created then the political conditions which, in combination with the unemployment, which rose in, you know, from the beginning of the 30s until 1933, it rose from first 1 million, then 2 million, and eventually in 1933 it was 6 million unemployed. Mm-hmm. And that created the conditions where the population was so freaked out, and you had the right-wing, left-wing, communism versus fascism, or communism versus Nazist confrontation. And these were the conditions under which then the emergence of Hitler was possible. So I think, you know, if on the other side, in 1931, when Dr. Wilhelm Lautenbach proposed a New Deal plan for Germany, I mean, he didn't call it New Deal, but it was based on the exact same principles. This was then stupidly rejected. And if it would have been adopted, the economic conditions which 2 years later made the rise of Hitler possible would have been eliminated, and, you know, the Nazis would have disappeared, because in 1932 they already started to have losses in the elections, and the whole problem could have been resolved. And I can only with the utmost emphasis say, compare what happened in the 30s in the Depression with Roosevelt, with the New Deal, and compare that what happened with the corporativism of Mussolini and what happened with the Yalmar-Schacht policies and Hitler, because right now there are only these two alternatives on the table, either a fascist solution or a New Deal and a Franklin D. Roosevelt solution on a global scale. And the good thing is that, you know, even in other countries, there is a big discussion about a New Deal. For example, President Putin has in the year of 2007 repeatedly said that, you know, Russia needs an alliance with the United States in the tradition of Roosevelt. Russia needs a New Deal. The whole world needs a New Deal. The previous president of Argentina, Kirchner, said Argentina needs a New Deal. The former economic minister, Tremonti, with whom Lyndon LaRouche had a very important conference in Rome together, he is continuously calling for a New Deal for Europe. And, you know, I think it is really important that people give it a thought, compare what was the outcome of the Depression in Europe, namely fascism and war, and what did Roosevelt do? Because these are the two options today.
And that's why Lyndon LaRouche is emphasizing his legislative packet, which is modeled on the FDR policy, as opposed to the efforts that most Americans still don't get to put a fascist government in with Michael Bloomberg in the United States. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. It's February 2nd, 2008. For those of you who want your friends to hear this, who missed this discussion today, it is archived on the LaRouchePub.com website. And you can burn a CD, get it around to your friends, get people talking about this, because this is what it's going to take to break the silence of in the political realm. Now, I want to bring in our other LaRouche Youth Movement member now, Mihwa Steger. Mihwa was at a meeting last weekend with Lyndon LaRouche where you had a very wide-ranging discussion. Lynn went through in-depth this two-tier policy, but you also had a lot of discussion of science and music. And we've been talking today. Sky brought up how we're bringing a living sense of history through the website. In your organizing, both with the choral work you do, but just the day-to-day organizing on the campuses, how do you bring in these deeper cultural scientific questions while you're talking to someone about a two-tier credit system?
Well, in order to do that, you actually have to bring them within a real functioning process, because the biggest thing I've learned in working with the chorus, as Lynn had said last Saturday, is that you can't ever have really long-winded plans, that we're beginning to move away from, you know, having to structure everything, but actually being able to think on our feet. And especially in a time of war like this, where, you know, we're on the campus every day, we don't know what we're going to be dealing with in talking to the students, what type of emotional state, you know, what they know in terms of what's happening in the political situation. But the most important thing is this question of dynamics and being able to respond in a situation when it's needed. And so we try to bring people into a process, bring people right into chorus, and have them interact within a process that gets them interacting with their generation at the highest level. And it's through processes like these, you know, bringing them in on the Kepler and working through these pedagogicals, that they can begin to fight and figure out what real creativity is and what their parents' generation essentially shied away from.
Well, as Helga mentioned earlier, that you had this conscious effort, this deliberate effort to destroy education. Sky also brought this up in terms of the what's been done to take away history. We've had the pamphlet that was written by the LaRouche Youth Movement on Is the Devil in Your Laptop? We've been getting it out now for about a month. What kind of reactions are you getting when you go in and challenge the cultural hegemony of MySpace and emails and MP3 players and people who walk around like Martians with plugs in their ears all the time?
No, it's true. They actually walk around with their plugs in their ears, and we have to tell them to unplug themselves. But we've gotten extremely excited responses, because these are young people that know there's a problem in society, but we're able to give them a sense of what the nature of the problem is and how to begin to address it. And that gets them very optimistic, because, you know, in a time of tragedy like this, we're going to be that voice of reason that comes in, that gives them that way out, that sense of remedy for the situation. So they've gotten eaten up on college campuses wherever I've gone, and the responses that we've gotten have been pretty optimistic.
Well, Helga, Mihwa just brought up the question of tragedy. You've written a great deal on this, from particularly the work you've done in creating the Schiller Institute and bringing to people the works of Schiller and the inability to reflect on these kinds of historic questions from a higher standpoint. If you look at this present situation, it really does have all the earmarks of a terrible tragedy that, if we don't succeed, years from now people will look back at this and scratch their head and say, how did this happen? How do you, when you organize people, I know for you this whole question of tragedy is something which is urgent and pressing. How do you communicate this to people in real time?
Well, you know, it is quite natural that when people, you know, who most of the time live in amazing state of denial. I mean, people are really skilled to block out reality to an extent which is amazing, even if you deal with it every day. And then comes a moment when all of a sudden they fall like through the sky and they say, oh my God, it's really happening. Oh my God, what you say is really true. And we have that now really all over the place where long-standing contacts say, oh, I always thought you were so interesting people, but now I realize everything you said is really true, and I really have to look at your solutions because I never really paid attention to it. I never thought it's really necessary to go that far. And then people get scared, you know, because they realize that the foundations of society are shaking, that everything they believed in their whole life, you know, pensions, healthcare, security, a functioning government, all of this is going out of the window. And then people get scared. And then the question is, you know, how do you deal with this? Because, you know, people are scared for the wrong reasons. They all of a sudden say, but what about my money? Can you give me an advice? I have some stocks. Should I sell them? Should I keep them? Should I buy gold? Should I do this? And they go into these real spirals, you know, and when I point out to them and say, well, wait a second, you know, you should be concerned about what could happen to civilization and mankind if we don't change this and put a different agenda on the table. And be afraid for the fate of mankind and not for your own little thing, because you know you cannot solve it in your family arrangement or private life. So what I tell people always is, you know, and I think I'm very thankful to Friedrich Schiller because he has developed this notion of the sublime, and I don't know of any other thinker or poet who has really developed such a lofty ideal of mankind by saying that, you know, man as a physical creature is very fragile. Every ox is stronger, every bull is more powerful, every elephant has more weight to throw around. So if you just look at man as a physical being, you know, it's very easy that fear turns people into slaves. And, you know, Roosevelt is famous of having said this famous sentence, you have not to fear nothing but fear itself. And if the circumstances turns people into fearful people, Amelia Boynton Robinson has spoken about that many times also, people become unfree, they become slaves, they become underlings. And then naturally they are manipulatable by an oligarchical force. So what we have to do, and what I'm trying to do, is I try to tell people that the only way how you can remain free in times like that, that is inner-directed and mentally free, is that you have to connect your identity to ideas which are larger than your own personal life. That, as Schiller would say, you have to connect your own short lifespan to the long chain of generations before you and those who will come after you, and, you know, live your life in such a way that you contribute something to make that which you give to future generations more rich than what you received. And if you have a compassion for mankind as a long process in this way, well, then you realize all of a sudden you are thinking bigger, you are free, because you are not physically secure, but you are morally secure, and that is what counts. So I think that the studying of the great tragedies, especially, you know, but in the ancient tragedies, I only would mention Aeschylus and the Proboscis Unbound as the only exception, you know, which would pass Plato's criticism of the ancient tragedians, because he does have an inkling of this sublime as a way of elevating yourself above, you know, the tragedy. And naturally, especially Schiller, they can really be very, very helpful by getting your thoughts clear. And, you know, it's quite normal that people get freaked out and get fearful. But it's only when you really think about the larger issues, you know, what do you do with your life? What do you do to gain immortality, not, you know, as something, you know, which you can put on as an epaulette, but as something which is the only thing which makes human life worth living. And, you know, that you have to be one of those world historical individuals which helped to bring mankind out of the present pit. And, you know, since I have a very clear idea how the future can look like, I have a very vivid idea of what a new, just new world economic order would look like, and how a cultural renaissance would really liberate man and increase the creativity around the globe of every continent. And that's, you know, when you focus on that and say, I cannot stand that the world is going to pieces right now, and I'm going to do everything I can, you know, to really help to put a different agenda on the table, then you realize you forget about your little me and your little fears, and you can start thinking clear again.
And I think, Skye, that really gets at the question that you raised in terms of helping people rediscover history as a living process, that when you're doing the work in the whether it's the hyperinflation or on Gauss's discovery of the orbit of Ceres, that you're putting yourself into that historic process and actually living that.
That's exactly it. I think of it as it's the role of a good dramatist, which is you're supposed to put yourself forward as sort of the conduit for history. You have to find some way to make it something that's alive in yourself, and then by so doing that, use that to convey the same concept, that same kind of intensity to a population as a whole. I mean, historically, that was the only way any civilization had maintained a living contact with all of the generations of history that lived before them. You'd use drama, you'd use the culture in such a way that you can keep that this idea that your life is not the extent of your responsibility or even your realm of action, your ability to act. That your responsibilities and your ability to act extend generations before you and generations after you. And if people have that sense, they wouldn't fall for anything that's going on right now. All this idiocy about ideas of stimulus packages, the idea that playing with the interest rates can have any effect at all on the physical economy besides just blowing the thing out. People would have a real sense of what economics were, and we'd be able to get on to some real progress. We could move on off the planet, push for the continental development of Eurasia, finally get the development of Africa off the ground again, stuff we should have done 100 years ago.
And you have to get people to laugh at themselves for their smallness. And I think, I know, Mihwa, you asked a question of Lynn about the tension, the process of tension that goes on in any artistic creation, whether it's singing a choral piece or working through Kepler. I mean, that's really what we're talking about in the organizing, right?
Absolutely. Because what young people are addressed with is a real crisis, a physical crisis that's happening around them. And they're being hit with the fact that they have to develop themselves as individuals that, you know, have the potential to solve these problems. And so, you know, the natural, somewhat natural inclination is to shy away from these types of tensions. And I can see it in the chorus work and in the subjective work with people where they tend to shy away from the subjective wall of fire, and they tend to move in the other direction of which is easier. And there's going to have to be a few of us that are going to have to point people in the right direction back into the wall of fire and get them to face it.
We have about a little more than 6 minutes to go, and I wanted to know, Skye or Mihwa, if either of you had a question for Helga.
I've got plenty, in particular I thought was a really interesting cartoon from 1934. It was a cartoon done in German called The Dictator of Dictators. And it was an image of Hjalmar Schacht sitting at a desk giving orders to Goering, Hitler, and Goebbels. Now I was wondering how clear was it for a lot of the population that not just the Versailles attacks, I know some of that was used even by the Nazis in propaganda, but also the measures that came afterwards. How much was that clear to the German population that was run from outside and by Britain?
Well, I think it was absolutely clear. As a matter of fact, you know, the hatred against the Versailles Treaty and the complete sellout of Germany which, you know, everybody knew who were the other parties at the Versailles conference. Basically, that was absolutely known, and that is what contributed to the growth of both the communists and the Nazi movement, because, you know, they would have never, I mean, the way how this came into being was that the World War One, which, you know, was this ground, this grinder, this meat grinder of Verdun, of 4 years of fighting out of the, you know, the dungeon, not, I don't know this word now in English, basically, you know, out of the, the Grabenkriege, I'm sorry,
trenches.
No, out of the trenches, exactly, you know, which had destroyed an entire generation of young people and derooted them completely. So that created sort of the precondition, but then it was the experienced injustice of the Versailles Treaty, which everybody knew, which made it possible for the Nazis and the communists to recruit in the way. I don't think that people really all knew, you know, the you know, extent of it. But for example, I mean, you had the Eugenic Society in the United States, which was headed by Averell Harriman at the time. They had extensive contacts with the Nazi movement in the 20s. They sent their own doctors to the Nazi doctors, and they admired the race hygiene laws of the Nazis. So it was clear that there were these international connections. The case of Edward the VIII was also known, that he was very sympathetic to the Nazi movement. But I think, you know, this cartoon is sort of a rarity because, you know, I mean, I think it definitely reflects the artistic truth-giving by the artist. But, you know, I think in general it was really known, but it, you know, that's what happens, you know. Correct oppositions or correct issues are then being exploited and turned into a game on the British chess table.
So it was known, but people wouldn't speak it for the most part.
No, they spoke it. They spoke it, but you see, it's one thing if you think it's unjust what was done, and if you understand the real string pullers and the real geopolitical game. You know, people tend to react on a sense certainty basis to these kinds of things, and they don't understand the orchestration. You know, they don't understand that. I mean, we have done extensive historical studies on the Hitler project. Hitler was not, you know, somebody who grew into prominence on his own merit. He was groomed by the oligarchy, by organizations like the Thule Society, who gave him courses in rhetoric, who really built him up. And, you know, the people who sponsored him from abroad, from both the United States and also especially Montagu Norman, who used to be the head of the Bank of England at the time, they knew perfectly well if they would sponsor him, then sooner or later it would come to a war between Germany and Russia, and they wanted to destroy both countries.
Well, I think that's the importance why Lyndon LaRouche keeps insisting that we take up this Bloomberg question. You look at Schwarzenegger, whose father was a very active Nazi, a member of the police in Austria, a Nazi party member. You look at George Shultz, who's been responsible for this for a long time, for promoting not only the breakup of the Bretton Woods system, but every step of the way, fighting against regulation, fighting against FDR. You can name the names of these people, Shultz and Felix Roeten, and these two seem to have a stranglehold on this. Helga, we have just a little more than a minute. Any thoughts on the U.S. election?
Well, I think, you know, hopefully, you know, the impulse towards an FDR policy, which has been expressed by Hillary Clinton, will be victorious, because, you know, if not, then the world will go to hell. I don't tell you anything new if I tell you that the image of the United States has been totally, totally ruined with the Bush-Cheney administration. And it's really on the edge. Like, for example, you know, just yesterday it became known that the Defense Secretary Gates is now demanding in an extremely aggressive tone that Germany should extend its combat troops to the south of Afghanistan, which the German government has flatly and energetically refused, which is a complete novum to happen, you know, because, I mean, normally the German government does everything what Washington orders. But the insanity of this by, you know, telling the overstretched German army to go into an area which is completely taken over by the Taliban and the drug lords and so forth, you know, everybody sees this is totally insane on top of the situation in Iraq, Pakistan, and so forth. And, you know, this, if they keep pushing this, I can assure you this is going to ruin things even more, and even the alliance of NATO is not for eternity if this keeps up. So I think that, you know, everybody wishes really at the depths of their heart that the United States should come back and become a republic again and fulfill the promise of the American Revolution. There are plenty of people in the world who really wish that the United States should crash against the wall and get destroyed. But you know, they are quite foolish because, you know, as Lynn has pointed out, and as anybody who clearly thinks about the situation should know, if the United States would go in a fascist direction or even collapse and bring down the rest of the world economic and financial system with it and still have a very significant military force, the world is not going to survive it. So, you know, I think that what I'm expressing in terms of the hope that the United States should really, you know, basically find its soul again, to find back the beauty of the American Revolution, of people like Benjamin Franklin, of John Quincy Adams, of Lincoln, of FDR, of Roosevelt, of Franklin D. Roosevelt, of Martin Luther King. You know, I mean, the whole world really has a longing for the United States to come back on its feet and become a beautiful beacon of hope and temple of liberty again.
Well, Helga, thank you very much for joining us. I know that Mihwa and Sky are among the leaders of the LaRouche Youth Movement who are out to create a new generation of leadership with precisely that kind of commitment for the United States to function as it should in the world. So, Helga, thank you for joining us. Sky and Mihwa, thank you. And we'll be back with you next week for the LaRouche Show.
Bye.
Bye.
So long.